what mysteries went down with the sinking of the Lusitania? Eric Larson will be here to talk about his new book, Dead Wake.
So here's this ship. Everybody knows it's coming. Everybody knows the submarine's in its path. Nothing's done. Nothing's done to stop it. So there is a mystery there.
How do black conservatives view contemporary racial politics? Orlando Patterson will talk about two new books, Shame by Shelby Steele and Please Stop Helping Us by Jason Riley, which he reviews this week.
He said something which is also curious, that, you know, he is a proud black person and that he would not put up with that, with racism. And he had several other passages in which he made it quite clear that he takes a strong stand on race.
Alexandra Alter will share her notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Eric Larson is here now to talk about his new book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
It is the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania on May 7th. Is that how you came to write this? Did you sort of know, okay, this is coming up, or how did you come to this subject?
Actually, not at all. In fact, the conception of this for me was about 5 years ago. I was on the fence. I mean, Lusitania is not the typical idea that I'm likely to take on. It's kind of low-hanging fruit, you know, but I've got this maritime thing, and you know, Titanic's been done to death, and here was the Lusitania, and I thought, it might be interesting to do it. And being a former journalist, I thought to myself, okay, why write about it now? I knew the anniversary was coming, so it's just that little card to stick on the scale that tipped the balance just enough to say, okay, maybe I'll start looking into this.
You know? And what was it about this particular ship, this story, that interested you?
As I started reading about it, what I came to see was that there was a really unusual opportunity to practice the art of narrative nonfiction, if you will. And that is that the depth of the archival resources on the subject was so deep, so textured, so rich. And I came to see that, in my view, it had not been taken full advantage of. I saw an opportunity to put on my Alfred Hitchcock hat and really kind of explore the possibilities of suspense in nonfiction, because there were so many wonderful things. Intercepted telegrams decoded by the super secret spy agency. I mean, President Wilson's passionate love letters to his girlfriend. All this material. Later his wife, yes. All this stuff that really suddenly came to seem to me like I can work with this. I can have some fun with this, trying to put people on that ship in as suspenseful a way as possible.
And was there an element of suspense for you in terms of your research, things that you wanted to find out that kind of drove you in your reporting of the story?
Well, it all was new to me. I think I, like many, many Americans, had sort of lodged the Lusitania on a sort of dusty timeline in the past where it was one node on the way to World War I. Everything that I came across was new to me, including the fact that, frankly, Lusitania was not why we got into World War I. That's the perception, though, that tends to be conveyed in survey history courses and so forth. As I was doing my research, I would ask anybody who would listen and who actually knew what I was working on, meaning daughters and family and so forth. I would ask, so what's your perception? You know, after the sinking of the Lusitania, how long did it take to get into World War I? And the estimates ranged from 2 days to 2 months. Well, it took 2 years, you know, and in the end, when Wilson asked Congress for a declaration that a state of war already existed with Germany, he never mentioned the Lusitania. Many other things had happened in the intervening 2 years.
Let's set the stage a little bit in terms of World War I obviously was already underway. We were not in it. This was about 10 months into the war. What was going on?
The war started in August 1914. The Lusitania was sunk on May 7th, 1915. So the war was still relatively young. But it had already become very clear that World War I was going to be a war unlike any other in terms of tactics and frankly, the involvement of civilians as victims of war.
Lusitania is sailing from where to where and what happens? For those who, you know, kind of, they know the Titanic story and they know this happened somewhere vaguely after, but don't remember
right.
the details.
I know. It's a shame that the story has actually been kind of eclipsed by the Titanic. Had there never been a Titanic, I do firmly believe that the Lusitania would have been the James Cameron film and Leo DiCaprio
right.
might have been the
it could still
know, passenger.
Be.
It could still be. But so the ship set sail from New York on May 1. Pier 54, a pier in the city. And the crossing should have been just a five-day crossing, but there was one of the many secrets in this whole thing was that, and this was kept from the passengers, was that the ship was only operating on three of its four boiler rooms. This was an economy measure. So instead of making 25 knots, it was making about 21 knots, which doesn't sound like that significant a difference, but it works out to about one full day of voyaging, which turns out to be actually fairly crucial given the ultimate outcome. The ship departed New York on May 1st, was scheduled to arrive in Liverpool the following Saturday, May 8th, early in the morning. On May 7th, just off the Irish coast, one of the most beautiful of days, it was torpedoed and sunk in 18 minutes. By a German U-boat commanded by one Kapitänleutnant Bader Schweiger. Young guy, handsome guy, 30, well-liked, colleague of his in the submarine service, once said that he couldn't hurt a fly.
What kind of boat was Lusitania? Was this a luxury ship? Was this a fast ship? I mean, there was so much made about the Titanic as this unsinkable ship.
Right.
What was the Lusitania?
The Lusitania at this time was, in fact, the biggest, fastest, and most luxurious passenger ship then in service. I say in service because other ships were bigger and maybe even more luxurious at one point, but they were already commandeered by the British Navy to become troop transports, and the competing German ships had all been interned in neutral ports. The Germans did not want their ships to be co-opted by the British Navy and used against them. So it was a very large ship, very glamorous. I mean, you could get a stateroom actually with a wood-burning fireplace. You know, it was
A Vanderbilt on board.
There was a Vanderbilt on board, Alfred Vanderbilt, who was sort of a rake. It was very glamorous. It was also perceived to be, the unsinkable thing hadn't been applied to the Titanic. And the same thing held with the Lusitania. It was perceived to be too big and too fast to be caught by any German submarine. But beyond that, there was the pervasive belief that no German commander of a submarine would ever think to attack a civilian liner because that's not the way naval warfare was done.
And was this a terrorist attack?
It wasn't a terrorist attack. It was in the course of – it was war. You know, this was what the German Navy had begun doing. It was a violation of all the codes of naval warfare that had existed before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's partly why on that particular morning, May 1, 1,200 passengers got on that ship, a full complement of passengers. Only a couple of people canceled out of concern. We should note that very morning in the papers in New York, there was an ad placed by the German embassy, or notice placed by the German embassy, warning passengers that they traveled at their own risk, that if they entered the war zone, which Germany had declared in the waters surrounding the United Kingdom, that if anybody traveling on a ship of any kind, neutral or British, it was doing so at his own risk. In fact, in one newspaper, the New York World, that notice appeared right next to the Lusitania ad. But people got on the ship anyway because they had absolute confidence that this thing was so big, so fast, that they'd be safe no matter what.
And it only took 18 minutes for the ship to go down. How many people died and how many survived? Who survived?
Well, there were about 2,000 people altogether on board. That's passengers and crew. Of that, about 1,200 people were killed. There were, in fact, 33 infants aboard. Only six of those survived. 600 passengers were actually never found. And 123 of those dead were Americans, which was, of course, perceived at the time to be kind of the crucial issue for Wilson and America.
So why did it sink so quickly?
Well, it's a combination of disparate forces that happened to converge at that particular moment in the Irish Sea, there have been lots of conspiracy theories about the a so-called second explosion, that maybe it was caused by secretly stashed munitions, explosives aboard. No serious student of the Lusitania thinks that's the case anymore. What happened was really a Hail Mary shot by a torpedo commander whose torpedo actually happened to work. The one he fired before in a different attack failed. The one he fired really afterward in another attack failed. Torpedoes had a 60% failure rate. This one happened to hit. Not only did it happen to hit, it happened to hit in exactly the right place to sink the ship, but not the place that Schweiger thought he was aiming at, because he miscalculated the speed. But it hit a place that was just so perfect. It was the Achilles heel of the Lusitania, although no one, of course, knew that prior to that point. And it caused such significant damage, and so much water was allowed to enter the ship, not just through the initial breach, but then also through many, many portholes that had been left open because the day was so warm. That people wanted their portholes open for ventilation, even though it was against the captain's orders. So much water entered the ship so quickly that the ship took on a 25-degree list. This, of course, forced further water in. It was still moving at 18 knots when its engines, all control of its engines, failed, so it couldn't stop. And traveling at 18 knots, you have a situation that further exacerbates the flooding. It's called forced flooding. So much water was entering the hull through this breach that it also made its way into the first boiler room number one. And the best theory that anybody has now, two forensic studies by forensic engineers have both independently came up with this as the reason for that so-called second explosion, which was more of an eruption that kind of traveled the length of the interior of the ship. The cause was some kind of catastrophic disruption of the steam distribution system. The influx of water causing maybe the main steam line to explode, maybe one of the boilers. Any steamship in that era wasn't, in fact, a floating bomb under the right or wrong circumstances. So that is the pervasive belief now. Interestingly, Captain Turner, who of course was aboard when the torpedo struck, his first instinct about that so-called second explosion was that it was a main steam distribution line.
Did he go down with the ship?
We'll leave that to readers to figure
out. All right, we won't give away too many spoilers. I do want to talk, though, about the larger political situation. Winston Churchill was the first Lord of the Admiralty. We talked earlier about the captain of the U-boat that sunk this. Sort of, how deliberate was this? How much did the people, political leadership and military leadership in Germany and in the UK know? I mean, how much?
Well, you know, in terms of the Lusitania itself, I mean, it is not the case that that Schweiger was stalking the Lusitania. He wasn't. He was under orders to sink any large troop transport that he saw emerging from Liverpool. That was his specific order, and he was assigned.
And he assumed that this was a troop transport?
Well, we don't know that. Here's what we do know. We have his war log, which was his detailed account of his voyage from the time he left Germany to the attack, and then also subsequently as he returned to Germany. It was a tremendous resource because you really get into the mind of a submarine commander. And this voyage, this patrol, was a miserable one for him. The weather was terrible. It seemed at times as if all ships had sort of left the surface of the sea. He had few targets. He was chased by destroyers for an inordinately long time.
And it's a terrible thing to be on a U-boat at that time. A
terrible thing. Even though depth charges did not exist yet, if you were being chased by a destroyer, you had to stay underwater. And one of the interesting things about World War I submarines was that they couldn't stay under very long. In fact, during his entire voyage, his patrol, as he would have called it, he was underwater really very little of the time, because even though that's how submarines made their attacks and so forth, they could not sustain it for terribly long.
And then going to what the UK knew at the time, did Churchill know? I mean, there's been speculation that he knew that the Lusitania was under threat.
Here's what was playing out. As I was talking, you know, there was Schweiger having this miserable voyage, fog and so forth. And actually at the last minute, he had decided that he was done. He was running low on fuel, surprisingly low. He had concluded the patrol. He was essentially turned around and headed home. when the fog lifted. That was one factor. So again, he was not stalking the ship. However, what the British knew is a very interesting part of the story. There was this super secret agency called Room 40, which had been set up early in the war to take advantage of three nearly miraculous events, all of which led to the recovery of German code books. So Room 40 was able from early days in the war to read every German naval communication sent by wireless, which was a tremendous, tremendous thing. Among those communications were a series of communications about an extraordinary surge of U-boat activity starting around the 28th or 29th of April 1915. Four submarines, four U-boats, among them U-20s, Fokker's U-20, were being dispatched to hunt troop transports in a sort of a different location in the UK because there had been a rumor planted by British intelligence that the British were going to invade Germany from the sea, a coastal invasion.
Mm-hmm.
So these submarines were dispatched to try to destroy anything that any ship that seemed likely to be providing troops for that invasion. So this unit not only knew that these four submarines had been dispatched, but also knew that one of them was U-20, and knew that in fact its departure was delayed one day. Knew also exactly when it departed. Knew its exact path in the first 24 hours because Schweiger's wireless man tested his wireless approximately 14 times. Knew exactly the course, but more importantly, knew exactly where Schweiger was headed, which was a patrol zone off the coast of Liverpool, right in Turner's path, Captain Turner being the captain of the Lusitania, right in the paths of other Cunard ships and other merchant ships, you know, Liverpool being one of the busiest ports in the UK. So there was all this information that was known, none of which was communicated to Captain Turner or to Cunard. So that much we know about what Churchill and company knew. We also know that the big German naval transmitter at Nordreich had been routinely at midnight, in its midnight broadcasts, had been transmitting the travels of Cunard liners, including the Lusitania, departure dates, arrival dates, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We know as well that because of the warning that was placed in the New York papers the day of departure, May 1, the fact that the Lusitania was sailing was big news in New York and Washington, big news in London. So the Lusitania was front and center in people's minds after that departure. But again, nothing was communicated to Turner about what the threat that lay ahead. So here's this ship. Everybody knows it's coming. Everybody knows the submarine's in its path. Nothing's done. Nothing's done to stop it. So there is a mystery there.
For you, in doing the research and looking into these mysteries, what was the most surprising thing that you came across?
Boy, everything surprised me. Maybe that's the benefit of starting out completely ignorant. But yeah, everything surprised me. I think the thing that really drew me was the actual sort of the dimensions of the personal tragedy involved in this sinking. The things that happened to people, how this disaster unfolded, was really incredible. You know, I mean, by comparison, the Titanic was you know, tea at the Tavern on the Green or something. I mean, it was like, yes, they were. That ship sank very slowly. You know, I think it was at least several hours. And the lifeboats were launched in orderly fashion. You know, I'm talking about the Titanic now. In this case, 18 minutes, not only were the lifeboats not launched in a, frankly, civilized manner, they couldn't be launched because the ship had taken on this 25-degree list as soon as the torpedo had struck, almost within moments afterwards because of forced flooding, because of all the flooding that had occurred. 25% list that had caused all the boats on the starboard side to go out, to swing out from the ship, 8 to 10 feet. You know, if you can imagine being 60 feet above the water and trying to jump from the deck into one of those boats, it's not a really
right.
Terrific thing. Worse than that, though, were the boats on the port side. They had swung in, or if they were released from their bindings, would have swung in and were virtually unlaunchable, although people tried to launch them. In the end, I believe only six boats got away. Most people survived by jumping into the sea. And then their stories were pretty horrendous. Some people, one really unfortunate problem, is that there were, for the first and second class passengers, there was a new kind of life jacket, the body, B-O-D-Y, life jacket, body or body, which was said to be a vast improvement over the other life jackets, which were given to crew and to third class passengers, to the lowest level passenger. Well, it turned out that these new ones were not intuitive as to how you put them on.
Mm-hmm.
And an awful lot of people put them on, unfortunately, in such a way that their heads were submerged and their their posteriors were elevated.
Well, it's a terrible tragedy, obviously. Fascinating history. We're talking about the sinking of the Lusitania, nearing its 100th anniversary in May. And we're talking to Eric Larson, author of Dead Week, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania, which comes out on Tuesday and is reviewed this week in the book review on our cover by Hampton Sides. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Alter is here with news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
So I noticed a novel, you know, as I'm opening up my packages of books, one caught my eye. It's a young adult series that's based on a YouTube show, and I hadn't seen that before. YouTube seems to be an increasingly popular area that publishers are mining as they're looking for young writers with platforms. I'm using air quotes.
I know. I'm trying to think. Okay, so we've had Twitter novels.
Exactly.
We've had blog to novel is just old school at this point.
I wonder if there have been any Vine novels or Instagram
novel. Yeah. We need an Instagram novel.
That
next.
Would help.
Okay.
But no, this has definitely become an area that publishers are increasingly looking to. Simon & Schuster created a whole imprint that's basically dedicated to publishing YouTube stars. But they've
What's it called?
It's called Keyword Press, of course, keywords. And they put it together with a talent agency, United Talent. But most of the YouTube books that have come out so far have been, you know, nonfiction advice, makeup, humor, that kind of thing. There has been one other novel that came out in the UK from a YouTube star, but that sort of went south when it turned out that the YouTube star hadn't actually written it herself. This was Zoella, and some of her fans turned on her over that. In this case, the novel is—
But not all.
Not all. This novel by Paige McKenzie is called The Haunting of Sunshine Girl, and she actually co-wrote it with a young adult writer. So what it,
so was this a YA novel or
this
is
a this is a YA novel and it sounds like it's going to be a series. It's being compared to The Hunger Games like so many things are, but it's also sort of being described as like Veronica Mars. It's about a ghost hunter, and the YouTube series has I think been viewed 100 million times or more and has more than 200,000 subscribers, and it's kind of a mockumentary.
A technical question. Weinstein Books is the remnants of Miramax.
Exactly.
Books, right? And they don't do YA usually. Do they have a YA imprint or how
no,
is that working?
You know, I think what in this case they were looking for, this actually reminded me a lot of a book that you might see come out of Alloy. I think they were looking for a property, an idea that they could build like a joint book series and TV series out of it. So not only is this had its origins in YouTube, it's becoming a young adult series of books, and it's also going to be a television show. So basically they're going to exploit every possible medium.
So it's a multi-hyphenate content property.
That, I think you described it perfectly. but it'll be interesting to see how this book does, particularly, you know, we've seen now there have been a handful of YouTube stars that have come out with books, Grace Helbig, Michelle Phan. And, you know, the medium doesn't always translate. YouTube is obviously free. You can ingest it in a few mm-hmm. minutes. It's a different thing to sit down with a book that's going to take, you know, hours or days or weeks to get through. So it's always a question of whether the audience is going to come.
Have you read the book?
No.
Have you seen the YouTube video?
No.
Oh, no. When can our listeners read the book?
The book will be coming out later this month in March, and you can always see it on YouTube if you want an advanced preview of the novel.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Orlando Patterson joins us now. He is a professor of sociology at Harvard and the editor with Evan Fossey of The Cultural Matrix, Understanding Black Youth. Hi, Orlando.
Hi there.
This week in the book review, you review two books together. The books are Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed by Jason L. Riley, and Shame, How America's Past Sins Have Polarized Our Country by Shelby Steele, two books by black conservatives. But you say in your review that these are very different books. How would you characterize briefly each one, and then we'll talk in more detail?
Well, Riley's book is basically an attempt at a synthesis, a summary of secondary sources in the social sciences. He draws on economists and policy people who have written mainly from a conservative perspective for most of the chapters. He has a little bit on his own background, not much. He sprinkles autobiographical comments occasionally in, but the chapters are essentially an attempt at presenting the conservative viewpoint backed up by conservative social science summaries. It speaks on unemployment, on education, on affirmative action, the cultural issues, which most conservatives emphasize. He also puts up front, in fact, the second chapter is on what he called cultural matters. So that's basically his approach. Steele's approach is more an intellectual autobiography. He isn't attempting to summarize social science or policy literature. He writes from a very personal perspective on the nature of conservative convictions as a black person about the black condition. And his basic argument, like Riley's, is that social policies on behalf of black Americans have basically been a disaster. Not only did they fail to achieve what they set out to achieve, but that they then became the cause of the problems persisting. So that attempts at welfare reform, for example, not only failed to solve the problem of poverty, but was then became the cause of dependency and people not working, which then generated the problem. So the solution to the problem became the problem itself.
Right. The two books are different, I think, to a certain extent, probably because of the differences between the two writers. For our listeners who are not familiar with either Riley or Steele, who are they?
Well, Steele is a significantly older person. In fact, Riley dedicates the book in part to Steele. And Steele is more a cultural amateur social philosopher, person who writes from a very personal perspective about moral issues, about the ways in which people's attitudes towards life, people's failure to assume responsibility for their actions, and also the attempt by government to help, the way in which that sort of exacerbates the problem of moral responsibility. So he writes from the perspective of a moralist.
Mm-hmm.
Riley, who is on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, is more a policy wonk kind of person, if I may describe him like that, and attempts to make his argument by drawing on available conservative policy and economist views. He also, of course, adopts the conservative moral stance that of extreme individualism, the standard view that affirmative action is wrong. Not only is it wrong because it's unfair to whites, but because it does not help black Americans. It helps a few elite blacks to get into elite colleges, but in the end, does more harm than good.
Does their argument, their view of affirmative action differ from, say, you know, what Stephen Carter wrote 20 years ago or 25 years ago in Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby? Has the black conservative perspective on affirmative action evolved since then, or do these two men's views of it differ from that?
Carter was presenting individual view, the kind of concerns which I wouldn't describe him as a conservative so much as a right of center person, mm-hmm. who's just reflecting on how he as a academic felt about the experience of having been of benefited from affirmative action, the doubts that raises about his own abilities and whether he could have done it on his own. And the conservatives here, these two people, also assume that position, but they go much further. Carter didn't necessarily launch a wholesale attack on affirmative action or necessarily claim that it is all bad. My personal view is that there are important benefits, but there are also some problems. And I think a liberal person can quite legitimately take that position. The fact that it never works is simply not true from all we observe. Plus, as I noted very briefly in the review, I mean, there's this wonderful book by Ira Katz Nelson, who's a political scientist at Columbia, called When Affirmative Action Was White, which documented in great detail the ways in which the American state did help white Americans, working class Americans, the GI Bill, but also the ways in which the laws were administered in a way which favored working class whites over blacks. And this goes all the way back to the 30s, the laws that came out of the attempt to undo the Great Depression and so on. And in the case of black Americans, there's no doubt that one of the great successes of the civil rights movement, which is the rise of a black middle class in not only important segments of the economy, but also in political life, had to do not just with the passage of the Civil Rights Act, but also with important affirmative action rules. Interestingly, one of the most startling claims which Riley makes at the beginning of the work is to doubt very much whether the achievement of political power had much to do with any of the successes of black Americans, which almost bowled me over. Their position is an extreme one. It's unvarnished, complete conservative denunciation of any attempt by government to help the poor and the disadvantaged. And presumably this applies as much to the white poor, just as those in Appalachia, and the growing number of white working class or originally working class poor in the Midwest. And, you know, it's hard for a social scientist to take much of this too seriously. I made a special effort not to judge the works in purely social science terms because, I mean, this is simply incorrect. And I noted in passing, I think I tried to assess Riley in the terms that I would a social scientist who draws on secondary sources. And we do that a lot. I mean, I do that in some of my writings. And that is to say, I'm not drawing on my own original research, but attempting to make my argument by drawing on the available secondary literature. That's quite legitimate.
Right.
I don't think he did a good job at all. He contradicts himself in several places, glaringly so. So, for example, he noted that, you know, one of the sources of his success was the fact that his parents made the decision to get out of the ghetto, the inner city, to get away from the violence, to get away from the insecurity, and to get away from the people who don't seem to value education and so on, to a predominantly white community, which he felt was one of the best things they did for him. But then a couple chapters later on, he sort of lashes into attempts by the government to move inner-city blacks to more secure neighborhoods as another example of government interference and so on.
So is his argument an ideological one, that it's okay if an individual African-American family makes this decision, but not okay if the government facilitates that?
If the government facilitates it, yeah. That's part of it. Mm-hmm. And there are other issues which I have with it in detail. Some of the interpretations very biased. So, for example, he takes the very conservative position against the minimum wage laws. In interpreting that, he glosses over important differences. The economics literature, and this includes both liberal as well as most conservative position, is split on how minimum wage influences employment. And that's a legitimate split, which, you know, economists will continue to argue about. However, there is near universal agreement among economists, including all but the most conservative, that the minimum wage does have a beneficial effect in reducing poverty. And that's an important difference, which he simply sort of glosses over and
right.
simply says that, you know, it has a negative effect on both employment and doesn't help with poverty. It does help if your wage, if you're getting $12 an hour instead of $7 an hour. Over and over, it's errors like that. And sometimes in his eagerness to condemn Obama, he makes errors, one of them being an error of timing, as I noted. He claims that Obama's attempt at fixing the economy has been a failure. Well, I mean, the book, as I pointed out, was ill-timed from that point
right.
of view. So one after the other, I mean, I felt he could have done a better job in assessing the secondary literature and that he was too guided by his own biases. And I wish it's possible to make a more nuanced conservative position.
Right.
Now, in the case of Steele,
this is shame, how America's past sins have polarized our country.
Exactly. I couldn't take seriously his view that there's been a complete disaster as far as government policies go. But my own position was to judge him on his own terms. This is not a social scientist. And he also isn't even trying to summarize the social science literature as Riley was attempting to do. He's presenting the world from his perspective as a moralist, and his conviction that it's important that Black Americans, like all other Americans, take responsibility for their own actions and assume that freedom
right.
was the fundamental American value, and the less the state interference, the better for individuals.
One of the things that you talk about in your review is his personal evolution from 60s radical to Reagan conservative. And there's a pivotal moment there. How does that happen?
Yeah, you know, I was quite moved by that and a little taken by surprise, actually. So he comes from a working class background, I think mixed parentage, and was very good at swimming and had become the captain of his varsity team. He returned in the fall of his senior year to find all the other members of his team all very excited about the several weeks they had spent in this fancy lakeshore villa owned by his coach's mother. And he was completely taken aback by this because this was the first he heard about it. And they all assumed that he had made the choice not to go, either because he was working class and had to work or what have you. And the coach himself was very dishonest, as he claimed were all his fellow teammates. He made a very poignant, very persuasive, and very moving argument of how profoundly shocked and disappointed he was, not only in his white teammates, he was the only Black person on the team, but how disappointed he was with their hypocrisy. And he claimed that this was a turning point in his own life, not to be self-pitying and to recognize the dangers of hypocrisy. In other words, he became a moralist out of this and someone who he felt it made him much stronger because he made the decision, even though he was the captain, even though the coach and all his teammates pleaded with him to leave the team at once. And he said something which is also curious, that, you know, he was a proud Black person and that he would not put up with that, with racism. And he had several other passages in which he made it quite clear that he takes a strong stand on race. Part of his pride as a Black person is not to accept any handouts, not to accept any patronage from white people, and to take full responsibility for his life and his choices. And he goes on then to give sort of key points, key moments in his evolution. In the late 60s, 70s, as he saw the welfare state emerging and became increasingly convinced that after initially being very much in favor of the Great Society changes, he increasingly came to recognize that this wasn't working, this was doing more harm than good. And they finally, the big transition during the Reagan years when he became a Reaganite and gave up his the ideology of Black Pride and support from the state. And that, so I thought he did that very well. And this is not a position which he came to by reading Rand or by political expediency. It was a personal decision which evolved from his own observation among fellow blacks, and obviously observation of how some of the policies have failed. And I'm not saying for a minute that policies haven't failed, nor am I saying, and this is where I also sympathize with him, that there were not some negative consequences as a result of some of the programs which were pursued.
We're talking about two controversial new books. The books are Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed by Jason L. Riley, and Shame, How America's Past Sins Have Polarized Our Country by Shelby Steele. Orlando Patterson reviews both of them this week in the book review. Orlando, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Well, there are four new titles on the hardcover fiction list. And interestingly, new at number 15 is a book called Hush, Hush by Laura Lippman. I say interesting because Laura Lippman, of course, is a famous crime writer from Baltimore. And we have another Baltimore writer, a famous Baltimore writer, Ann Tyler, still on the list with A School of Blue Thread, which is at number 5 in its third week. As far as I can tell, going back through the archives, this is the first time that Laura Lippman and Ann Tyler have ever been on the bestseller list together. So a little bit of a charm city there.
Well, we'll probably find out from Baltimore residents that there are many other Baltimore authors out there.
then new at number 13, Joanne Sluk continues her Hannah Swenson series of mysteries, culinary mysteries, mysteries with recipes included.
Is that a new genre, culinary mystery?
She has made it a genre. Hannah Swenson, her protagonist, is a small-town Minnesota baker who keeps stumbling across corpses. It's your typical kind of cozy mystery setup where she finds these bodies. In this case, the new book is called Double Fudge Brownie Murder. The victim in this case is a judge, and Hannah Swenson herself comes under suspicion of the murder.
I'm thinking suspicion of eating the double fudge brownies, but I guess that's not the mystery.
Death by chocolate.
All right, what's next?
New at number 4, Danielle Steele has a new novel out called Prodigal Son. And finally, Jeffrey Archer continues his Clifton Chronicles with Harry Clifton. That book is called Mightier Than the Sword, new at number 3.
And nonfiction?
Nonfiction, there are three new titles. At number 9, Bill Gifford has a kind of popular science book called Spring Chicken, which is looking at the process of aging and ways that you can try to live longer. Then at number 3, Mark Goodman, a cybersecurity consultant who's worked for Interpol and the FBI, various other law enforcement organizations, has a terrifying new book called Future Crimes, which, even though it's called Future Crimes, it's really looking at the current state of crime online. And basically, he says criminals are outrunning us all, that there is no such thing as cybersecurity. But he does offer some advice on how you might protect yourself if you're going to enter those waters. Finally, new at number 2, Kim Gordon, who played bass in the seminal post-punk group Sonic Youth and was married to the other member of that band, Thurston Moore, has a memoir called Girl in a Band, and that book enters the list up at number 2.
Well, we should also note, not quite brand new, but staying on the list is our cover review from a few weeks back, kind of a surprise bestseller here with H's for Hawk, moving up to number 5.
Yeah, number 5 in its second week. That is 3 spots higher than it was last week. And it's a book that has already gotten a lot of great attention in England, where it was published last year. It won the Costa Prize, which goes to a book in any genre, just considered the best book of the year. It also won a prize for the best nonfiction book of the year, the Samuel Johnson Prize in England.
All right, so we've got chickens and hawks on the bestseller list.
And a nightingale over on the fiction list.
Maybe spring will come soon after all. Okay, thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.